This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, confusion over the number of bodies recovered from the Malaysian plane crash in Ukraine. The U.S. Secretary of State continues his Middle East peace efforts with a trip to Israel. Reporters Without Borders find social media playing a role in the Gaza crisis.
We reach a situation that we never reached before regarding use of social media or dissemination of hatred messages.
And Billy Joel wins a George Gershwin Prize. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The bodies of the victims of the Malaysian plane crash in Ukraine are en route to authorities in the Netherlands for examination and identification. 298 people were killed when their plane was shot down, allegedly from a region controlled by pro-Russian rebels. VOA correspondent Al Pessin is in Kiev. We asked, what do we know about the crash so far?
Well, we only know what the Western governments and intelligence agencies are telling us, and we also know Russia's version of events. I guess what we know, in fact, is that the plane disappeared from radar screens and ended up in several fields in eastern Ukraine in an area controlled by separatist rebels who are backed by Russia. What we're told is that it was shot down by a Russian-made and Russian-supplied anti-aircraft weapon that apparently was in the hands of the separatist forces.
What are the Russians saying?
Well, the Russians have said several things. At first, they blamed Ukraine for it. They said it was a Ukrainian aircraft missile. Then they said there was a Ukrainian fighter jet in the area of the Malaysian aircraft. And they're denying any involvement.
There seems to be some confusion over the number of bodies that have been recovered.
That's correct. According to the initial reports from the Ukrainian government, they understood that all of the bodies, or at least parts of all of the bodies, were on the train that was sent from the rebel-controlled area into the government-controlled area yesterday morning. But now that the international experts have had a chance to take a closer look at what was delivered, they feel like they may not have all the bodies. And so this is yet to be analyzed and determined. And as you mentioned, they're sending at least the first group on to Amsterdam today, and we'll get a much better picture. The difficulty is that although there are some experienced emergency workers who work for the government in eastern Ukraine, the area controlled by the rebels, we don't know how many they are. We don't know exactly what their skill level is. And we know that a lot of volunteers and various other people were used in the recovery of these bodies. So until the real forensic experts get a good look at what they have, we won't really know whether they have all of the bodies and, sadly, all the body parts or not.
And what about the wreckage of the plane itself? How is the investigation proceeding with the debris that is left?
Well, we don't know the answer to that. Again, there have been pictures of various volunteers and workers who have been around the site, but in terms of what's happening right now, we don't know. And that's the demand now. Now that at least most of the human remains have been delivered, the demand is access for fully qualified international investigators to, number one, see if there are any additional bodies out there, and number two, begin to investigate so that they can prove exactly what caused this airliner to go down, and number three, to recover the personal effects of the people who were on the plane.
What about security for these investigators?
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, they're not being allowed to go in at all. And even if the separatists agreed to allow them in, the question is, would there be any level of confidence that they would actually be safe in that area? So that would be up to the individuals and to their governments as to whether they would go into a rebel-controlled area. But since there have been these demands for access, one has to assume that they would find some investigators who were willing to go in if the proper guarantees were provided.
VOA correspondent Al Pessin speaking with us from Kiev, Ukraine. U.S. aviation authorities Tuesday temporarily prohibited U.S. airlines from flying to Israel's Ben-Gurion International Airport in Tel Aviv for at least 24 hours following a nearby rocket strike. VOA's Victor Beatty reports, despite last week's downing of the Malaysian jetliner over eastern Ukraine with a loss of all on board, aviation experts insist air travel worldwide remains by far the safest mode of transportation.
The Federal Aviation Administration issued a notice to airmen banning U.S. carriers from flying to or from Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport after a rocket strike about 2 kilometers from the airport's perimeter early Tuesday. The European Aviation Safety Agency Tuesday also issued a safety information bulletin strongly recommending airspace users refrain from operating to and from the Tel Aviv airport. Delta Airlines Flight 468 en route from New York to Tel Aviv with 290 passengers and crew was diverted in mid-flight Tuesday to Paris. Daniel Leon was aboard that flight.
Delta had to do what Delta had to do. It's quite unfortunate that we were literally an hour before landing in Ben-Gurion. But I respect the decision, right? I mean, they've got some rules that they have to obey by, and they explained to us why they were doing it. It was a bit confusion on the plane early on. But I think, look, we're on the ground now. They were extremely helpful.
Israeli authorities insist there is no security problem. Transport Minister Yisrael Katz said there was no reason to cancel flights and, in his words, yield to terrorism. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced he was traveling to Tel Aviv on El Al Airlines Tuesday to show solidarity with the Israeli people and prove the airport is safe. Bloomberg called the flight restrictions a mistake that, in his words, hand Hamas an undeserved victory. In Washington Tuesday, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf said the FAA notice is aimed at ensuring public safety, and it's not a political statement directed at Israel over its operation against Hamas militants in Gaza.
I would note that in 2012, the department also issued travel warnings for Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza in March, August, and December. So this is a step we have taken when we felt the situation on the ground warranted it. Obviously, that is a process that we go through that in no way is policy related or politically related. It is just related to how we can best protect American citizens. The FAA makes these decisions when they feel it's warranted, again, for the safety of United States citizens. And they, in response to the recent attack at Ben-Gurion Airport and the vicinity of Ben-Gurion Airport, after consultation with U.S. operators, felt today that it was important to issue this notice.
Concern about airline safety also follows last week's downing of Malaysian flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine, in which all 298 people on board perished. U.S. intelligence suggests ill-trained pro-Russian separatists using a sophisticated Russian-made surface-to-air missile are responsible. Aviation consultant Scott Hamilton of Liam Company says the FAA directive is not unusual.
The FAA has been issuing no-fly zones for quite a while, and in fact, since the Malaysian shoot-down, there have been a number of maps that have shown up in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere that have identified where there have been no-fly zones or restricted area fly zones that the FAA has issued. And some of those go back years, if not decades. Somalia, for example, northern Kenya. Those have been in existence for quite some time.
The FAA has also imposed restrictions on U.S. flights over Ethiopia, Iraq, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, and Ukraine. It identifies as potentially hostile regions Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Egypt, Sinai Peninsula, Iran, Kenya, Mali, Syria, and Yemen. Airline Captain John Cox, who is chief executive officer of the Washington-based aviation consulting firm Safety Operating Systems, insists that despite these recent incidents, including the March disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, it is very safe to fly commercial aircraft.
In spite of the tragic loss of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 and the Malaysian Flight 370. It has never been safer to fly. We flew 3.3 billion passengers last year that had the lowest fatality rate in recorded history. These tragedies do not change the fact of the safety of our aviation system.
Cox acknowledges that sophisticated weaponry like the SA-11 air defense system in the hands of non-military groups is very concerning.
The failure to correctly identify that airplane was unconscionable. It was inept. Military organizations, they don't have that kind of failure. But never in history have we had a surface-to-air missile rise to a cruising altitude of a commercial jet over 30,000 feet.
Cox says such missile systems are not in great numbers, and there will be a concerted effort to block out passage over airspace in areas where open conflict occurs. And he says aviation organizations, including manufacturers, regulators, and operators, all employ robust safety management systems to minimize exposure to potential hazards in flight. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Israel for talks on ending violence in the Gaza Strip that has killed more than 600 people. Kerry is meeting with U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns is traveling with the secretary, and we asked what the American official hopes to accomplish in Israel.
After more than a day of talks in Cairo, where he consulted with regional foreign ministers and the Egyptian president, this is an opportunity for Secretary Kerry to get a feeling for where Prime Minister Netanyahu is in this conflict, where the Israelis are in their ground assault in Gaza, and where the Palestinian Authority president Mahmoud Abbas is in this conflict. You know, as you know, President Abbas is the leader of the Fatah faction in the West Bank, not the Hamas faction in Gaza. So who speaks for Hamas has been a question in the process of trying to get to the ceasefire. Secretary Kerry is unable to speak directly with Hamas leaders because the United States has classified Hamas as a terrorist organization, so he needs to find interlocutors through which to gauge Hamas's willingness to join an Egyptian ceasefire.
Perhaps you'll remind us where the two sides stand on a possible ceasefire, what they would want in a ceasefire.
Hamas is looking for a relief from the Israeli and Egyptian blockade of Gaza, to include humanitarian supplies, but also commercial aspects. They feel that that has really choked off the lifeblood of Gaza. The Israelis are looking for security. They want to protect themselves from the rocket attacks and the network of tunnels that the Israeli Defense Forces have been clearing under that go from Gaza into Israel.
You mentioned that U.S. Secretary of State Kerry was in Egypt. Their first ceasefire offering was rejected. Are they still a player in this game?
Certainly. Egypt is always a player anywhere in the Middle East and certainly as well in search for this ceasefire. But it's no secret that the current Egyptian president, the former General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has a far rockier relationship with Hamas than the former Egyptian leader Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. That said, as we talked before about border crossings, that Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt is huge for Hamas. President Sisi controls that crossing, and as long as he has that authority, Egypt will be a player that has to be dealt with.
If Egypt doesn't act as a go-between, who else might go as a go-between?
The Qataris and the Turks, though it appears now that Qatar is playing a bigger role in this, there's some concern that they might be presenting a peace plan, a ceasefire plan that rivals the Egyptian plan. That is certainly not something that the Americans want to see. It's hard enough to get the two sides to agree to one ceasefire. You don't need competing ceasefires. But Qatar and Egypt are at odds over the treatment of the Muslim Brotherhood following the coup against President Morsi.
VOA correspondent Scott Stearns traveling with the U.S. Secretary of State today in Israel. Reporters Without Borders is accusing Israeli forces of targeting media places in the Gaza conflict zone. Also, that journalists for the two main Palestinian branches, Hamas and Fatah, are putting differences aside for the time being. We spoke with Swazik Dole, head of the Middle East desk at Reporters Without Borders. She began by talking about journalist casualties in the fighting.
Two news providers had been killed since the beginning of the operation on the Gaza Strip. The last one, his name is Khaled Hamid, and he was cameraman for the Continuity TV production company. And he was killed in Shijayeb while he was reporting on violence by Israeli troops against Palestinian paramedics assisting the injured people. Another Palestinian news provider was also killed since the beginning of the operation. His name is Hamdi Shihab, and he was a driver for Media 24 news agency. So we have now two Palestinian news providers had been killed, but also many had been injured.
Palestinian journalists working in the region right now, they face a very difficult situation because they're kind of in the middle of everything, aren't they?
Yeah, the fact that the situation drastically changed with the military operation after the killing of three Israelis, young Israeli, at the beginning of June in the West Bank near Hebron. Before that, we released a report saying that there was clearly the Palestinian journalists are like between three fires. One is between the Israeli and the Palestinian. Since 2007, there is a clear division between the Fatah and the Hamas since the Hamas took over on the Gaza Strip. So for a long time, there was also this division between Fatah journalists and Hamas journalists. And the Hamas journalists are targeted in the West Bank by the Palestinian Authority security forces and vice versa. Now we have this military operation, this new military operation on the Gaza Strip. We see that the conclusion that we reach, that the Palestinian journalists gave to me, even in Gaza at the end of 2013, are no longer the case. That still, that now and still the main danger for the Palestinian journalists in the West Bank, but mainly in the Gaza Strip, are the Israeli forces, mainly the raid, could be airstrike, but also intervention on the ground by Israeli troops in the West Bank. And we saw that the Israeli army target media places.
Do you find that journalists are heading for the Gaza Strip, or are they fleeing like other people are?
Everybody noticed that there's many foreign reporters in the Gaza Strip reporting from the Gaza Strip side to side with a Palestinian journalist. So we have both international and local journalists covering the conflict. But what is really concerning that now we also have since the beginning of the operation, a clear news information war, but as well a disinformation war. And it's through mainly social media. And we see that the level of hatred messages that we have this time on the mainly on Twitter, but also on Facebook, it's a passionate conflict. It always been, but I think that we reach a situation that we never reached before regarding at least the use of social media for dissemination of hatred messages from both sides.
Swazi Gadole, head of the Middle East desk at Reporters Without Borders in Paris. The UN Refugee Agency says it is unable to provide hundreds of thousands of refugees from the Central African Republic with life-saving assistance because of severe shortage of funds. The UNHCR is appealing for $210 million to help the refugees from CAR. American actress Mia Farrow, who is the UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador to the Great Lakes region, including CAR, spoke to the media at the UN on Tuesday about her just-concluded trip to CAR.
For now, what I wish for is for humanitarian aid access to all the people so they don't all die of starvation. And I wish for a cessation of the violence in Central African Republic so that people can reclaim the tatters of their lives and rebuild. It will take a generation. This kind of destruction will take time. There's been too much killing to say, well, in a month or a year, all will be forgotten. But you want to see the road toward peace.
Farrow said she will never turn away from her mission to help the people of the Great Lakes region of Africa. In conjunction with the Melbourne AIDS Conference, VOA is presenting a special series of reports that take a global yet personal look at AIDS. In today's report, we introduce you to 20-year-old Maurice Williams, who is now willing to come forward with the truth. Born HIV positive, he kept his status secret all his life. But thanks to research, doctors have given babies born with the disease new hope.
Dr. Deborah Prasad is passionate about the prospects of a medical breakthrough. And there seems to be new hope for babies that are born HIV positive.
We're on a mission to find a cure for AIDS, but this is going to be a very long road.
Dr. Prasad believes early drug treatment has far-reaching implications. Implications for people like Maurice Williams, who was born HIV positive. Maurice is getting regular checkups at Children's Hospital in Washington, where he was first diagnosed.
The first time I found out that I was HIV positive, I was 13, I was in the seventh grade, and I found out because I refused to take my medication unless I knew why I was taking medication.
He was raised by his grandmother, who never revealed to him he was HIV positive. Maurice's mother died from complications of AIDS. She never talked with him about the virus or his condition. His mother was only a child herself when her son was born.
Growing up, I was very angry with her for a long period of time. But I changed my anger around when I found out the anger wasn't beneficial to me. It turned into empathy because my mother wasn't even strong enough to really, you know, accept the fact that she was HIV positive. I feel like people put AIDS in a box. Clearly, AIDS isn't a death sentence anymore as it used to be.
Maurice is giving support to HIV positive teenagers like Shani.
Make sure you put all your effort in it. Give it all you got, but try to aim for the middle. Shani is 13, and 13 is the age where I found out that I was diagnosed HIV positive. And I didn't have anyone older than me or even anyone of my own age that I can relate to help me, you know, tell me that taking medicine will get better. Talking to him, it does more for me than maybe he even knows.
Dr. Prasad is meeting Maurice for the first time, where she can put a face to the people she's trying to help.
So we have a lot more work to do, where it becomes a disease that's living, like living with cancer or diabetes or any other chronic illness, because so many people are affected.
I may not be the person who changes the world, but I want to inspire the mind that does so. I believe that I can be great. I believe I can live a long life. I wasn't supposed to be here now.
For more on the fight against HIV/AIDS, visit our website at voanews.com. The U.S. Library of Congress is honoring American singer-songwriter Billy Joel with its Gershwin Prize for Popular Song. The prize was named for the 20th century American composer and pianist George Gershwin. Calling his selection for the prize a milestone, Joel said Gershwin has been a personal inspiration to him throughout his career. Now, Billy Joel singing one of his big hits, A New York State of Mind.
Some folks like to get away. Hey, take a holiday from the neighborhood. Have a flight to Miami Beach or Hollywood. I'm taking a Greyhound on the Hudson. In their fancy cars and their limousines.
And high in the Rockies,
under the evergreen.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On July 23, 1914, the Austro-Hungarian government delivered a 10-point, 48-hour ultimatum to Serbia following the assassination of Austria's Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo. Serbia's response was conciliatory, objecting only to the demand that Austro-Hungarians take part in its judicial proceedings. That slight dissent, however, was enough for Austria-Hungary to declare war, setting into motion a series of events that led to World War I. On this day in 1952, Egyptian military officers, led by future President Gamal Abdel Nasser, staged a coup d'etat, forcing the abdication of King Farouk I. The July 23rd revolution led to the end of the Egyptian monarchy. On this day in 1982, the International Whaling Commission voted for a moratorium on commercial whaling to protect all species of whales from overfishing. Some nations, notably Japan and Norway, ignored the ban. On this day in 2000, Tiger Woods won the British Open at St. Andrews, Scotland, to become, at age 24, the youngest player to win the career Grand Slam of golf. That is, the Masters, PGA Championship, U.S. Open, and British Open. And on this day in 1981, American singer Kim Carnes was on a 9-week run at number one on the American pop music charts with the Grammys Song of the Year, Betty Davis Eyes.
Her hair is hollow gold, her lips sweet surprise, her hands are never...
After this song became a hit, actress Betty Davis wrote letters to Kim Carnes saying thanks for making her a part of modern history. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
She's pure as New York snow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In June, the U.S. State Department released the 14th Annual Trafficking in Persons, or TIP, report. The report is a diplomatic and policy tool that evaluates governmental efforts to combat labor and sex trafficking. This year, it analyzed efforts to combat trafficking in 188 countries and territories, including 29 in the Asia-Pacific region. While there's progress, with more than 20 million estimated trafficking victims in the world and fewer than 45,000 victims identified, we know that we all have a lot more to do, said Ambassador at Large for Trafficking in Persons Luis Sidibaca in testimony before the U.S. Senate Subcommittee for Asian and Pacific Affairs.
We see both sex trafficking and forced labor, even state-sponsored forced labor, and the recruitment and use of child soldiers in some places, and pervasive victimization of migrants seeking better jobs. These are real people, people trapped in slavery, people in the sights of traffickers, people recovering from the trauma of being trafficked. They don't just impact our foreign policy, they touch our conscience.
Speaking before the same subcommittee, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, Scott Marciel, noted that as a direct result of the annual TIP report and sustained U.S. engagement, some foreign government officials no longer ask for the definition of trafficking or for proof that it exists within their respective borders. Rather, many officials are now asking what steps they can take to improve their anti-trafficking efforts. The United States works with governments in their efforts to combat modern slavery and develop policies and guidelines for conducting undercover investigations of human trafficking. In the Pacific Islands, we are encouraging local government efforts to address forced labor on fishing vessels. And we are working together with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, to enhance our partnership in combating the scourge of human trafficking. Combating human trafficking is a top U.S. priority. We are committed to working with governments and civil society in the Asia-Pacific region and around the world to prevent trafficking, protect victims, and prosecute traffickers so we can rid the world of modern slavery.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.